Hello and welcome to this EG Finance Talks podcast. I'm your host, Tim Burke, Deputy Editor at EG. December's general election appears to have given the real estate market a much-needed injection of optimism, with a rush of deals done in the final weeks of the year and a sense of relative certainty that has continued into the opening weeks of 2020. So what kinds of deals and developments do financiers expect to keep them busiest, and what trends are likely to dominate in terms of availability, structuring, and pricing of finance? To share their thoughts, I'm joined in the studio today by John Carter, Commercial Director in the Real Estate Division at Aldermore Bank, and Nicole Lux, Senior Research Fellow at Cass Business School, where she oversees the Commercial Real Estate Lending Survey. Thanks for making time to be with EG today. John, I wonder if we could kick off with a snapshot from you of how you've experienced the market over the weeks since the election. Was the Boris bounce real? Has it continued into 2020? What's your take on the market and how you'd characterize it?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Certainly, we have seen a lot more activity in December, and that's followed through into January, which is slightly unseasonal. I'm sure Boris would wish to take credit for that, but I think there's definitely been, with some certainty of a general election, there's been decisions made and people had that there is a lot more activity, and we have definitely seen that uptick. And even just wider, when you look at some of the reports coming out from the likes of HomeTrack or Connells in terms of residential, there's certainly been a positive move in terms of interest and in the residential space as well. So we have definitely seen an increase in activity from December and January. And as I said, that is quite unseasonal in January. It's normally a bit of a slower start. And I think we just, from the conversations we have just now, we expect to see that to continue really up until the summer.
How does that compare to what you experienced over 2019 as a whole?
2019 was, there was certainly a cliff edge mentality taking us to March 19 and a lack of activity really in January to March last year. That has built up a bit since then. And as I said, I think there's still been that uncertainty. We always have this conversation, property is still a long-term play. So it doesn't switch off decisions, but it does mean that people have maybe held back. And I think that pent up demand and pent up planning is really starting to play through now. The uncertainty of general election has removed. And a certainty of a way forward, I think, has given people a bit more confidence to go forward and take those decisions they were maybe trying to hold off on if they could.
Nicole, how does this tally with the big picture that you're tracking with the survey and conversations that you're having with lenders across the market?
Yeah, I think John is spot on there. I mean, we also hear that all lenders across the board are telling me that they are a lot more busy. I do believe, though, agents are putting a very positive spin on the market to get it going at this point. I mean, we will see into how many deals that really translates into, I think. So there is a bit of the Boris bounce, I guess you could say, but I'm still a bit skeptical as in where we will be by mid-year, for example, when really we will have more of an idea where negotiations with the Brexit deal go and so on. So definitely, though, lenders feel a lot more positive for 2020 and they hope to do a lot more business.
I'm shocked that you could suggest agents may be talking up the market in any way. what areas of the market might we expect to keep financiers busy over the course of this year? If we delve into certain sectors, certain types of development, where might we expect to see deals coming through?
Well, you mean busy in terms of good busy or busy bad busy, right? Because there's obviously the other story that I guess we'll come to about retail that will keep lenders very, very busy, but not really on a positive note, but more that they're going to enter workout scenarios. I mean, on the positive side, I mean, it's more of the continued themes that we've seen even in 2019 and maybe end of 2018. The alternative asset classes are key at the moment. Everybody is still very interested in lending into a sort of student housing, although they feel it's slightly overpriced. At the same time, PRS, everybody is interested in doing more PRS deals, but again, they're limited to find in sort of sizable transactions. And also the office market is slightly sort of coming back. And again, lenders are very positive on sort of lending, staying in London, lending to prime office, which will be very competitive also in terms of pricing again.
I remember looking at some anonymous comments from the half-year survey. And when lenders were discussing the office market, the name WeWork seemed to come up in almost every comment that you picked out at the time. How much of a concern is fallout in that co-working space for financiers?
Actually, also that. The worries about it have come down because WeWork now obviously has changed their policy a bit and being less aggressive and noted some issues. But also more and more lenders are saying that it's still less than sort of 20%. It's like around 10% or even 5%. It's really just still a minor sort of part of the market. So nobody wants directly lend to a building that's 100% let to WeWork, but anything where they're part of it and there's a mixed use, that's totally fine. Nobody seems to think it's like different from the story in retail, where the sort of online trading is now up to 25% or so. I mean, in the office space, the shared office model, everybody seems to think it's not going to reach these sort of levels.
John, what kind of deals will Aldermore be targeting this year? What do you have your eye on?
Yeah, so Nicole's right. The alternatives still play out quite well. Student is something that we do lend on, and we will continue to do so. I think it's right to be careful because there's certain cities around the country where development of student is fairly significant, and it's that classic of have we built too much or have we built too much of the wrong kind of of unit, and that gets into discussions around if it's studios and how the rents they can sustain. Or studios, where you get the two sharing a bathroom, if you heard that, you've got a smile there. Or those clusters. So it really does depend on the offering in terms of student. And that's something, you know, you get into in a lot of detail. I agree on PRS and build to rent. I think it is an area for focus. I think the changes in buy-to-let and tax is driving a difference in terms of the people who are operating in that space. There is a definite demand in terms of investment from some of those investment companies to buy into that as an end product. So, you know, the actual development of that still has an exit route. But clearly there's demand for people to live in those locations. I think some of that alternatives, hotels have been quite busy for some time. An interesting, talking about Brexit, is staycations are really growing as well. So if you look at the visit numbers, in the UK for hotels, they have continued to increase despite a slight reduction from European travel. There's been a massive increase in terms of US travel and Chinese travel, although given recent events, whether that Chinese travel will be affected in the short term, but it really has. You do still see a continued uptick in terms of that visit, so external and staycation. So like all of these things, it's down to looking at the underlying, what's the demand?
Sure.
To kind of drive the value of the end properties. I think office is quite interesting. A lot of office has started to become in short supply, mostly driven by permitted development rights in certain locations where there's huge conversions to residential. So you've almost taken lots of floor space out of the market to restrict the supply. So the natural thing is demand stays the same, but it looks okay because there's a lot less space to fill out. Retail, I know we'll come on to, but certainly I think some repurposing of some retail space will drive some development demand, and that really drives into the change in shopping. I think retail, where you've got an offering that's got an online offering as well as that bricks and clicks, then you've probably got a business that's got a long-term viability. If it hasn't, it's a case of where can you repurpose? And those last mile deliveries are now becoming, as we drive higher penetration in terms of online sales, the challenge from a logistics perspective is that delivery and that last mile delivery, and where does it need to be? So like all things of real estate, it gets back to there's got to be a purpose for it to drive the value. And if you can be really smart about who that is, that there's opportunities there. It's not to say all of it is, but there are opportunities there.
Well, let's delve more into that and the issues that are playing out in the retail space. I mean, I'm interested in how we're seeing lenders react to some of the woes in this sector. And also, as you make the point there, John, where the opportunities are, if you've got a smart strategy and you can spot the right inroad.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking specifically for Aldermore, I mean, we don't have a huge exposure to retail, but a lot of our retail exposure is secondary in nature, but with residential above it. So there's already, I suppose, a natural hedge that you've got some residential space above some retail. Mm. A lot of that retail space tends to get used where there isn't online. So if someone has to go and visit. But if it can't be used for that, is how do you repurpose? And residential can be an option for that. Or it could be some of the other retails we look at. I think some of the supermarkets, the likes of your Aldi's or your Co-ops, your Lidl's, again, in the right location. Certainly the larger, more superstore things, that's pretty much a thing of the past, I think, in terms of it's unlikely to get many of those now. And it really is against the strength of location and the underlying strength of the covenant on those as well. And really, those assets have kind of been done to death in terms of, you know, they're not something that we see very many of. And probably plays to one of Nicole's earlier comments. I think, you know, we probably see a lot more refinance than maybe new deals. And I think that's possibly her point, so a valid one earlier on about that being busy. Some of it will be refinance. There'll be some new transactions, but I think a fair bit might be refinance, or it just comes to a natural trigger point of an expiry of facility, or somebody wants to do something to repurpose an asset, and where they are banked just now is not the right place to do that. So I think that's what drives some of that activity, and where maybe some people will be positive and others will just say, well, that's really not for us.
What are your thoughts, Nicole? Again, when you shared some anonymous comments in the half year survey, lenders seemed extremely pessimistic, very downbeat about the retail space. Are you seeing any anecdotal evidence that there might be hints of optimism starting to come through as new opportunities emerge?
Yeah, let me come to that in a minute. I just wanted to make one comment about what John said about, again, the refinancing. I mean, also, if we think that in the survey we did report that we had a peak of origination in 2015-16, these are obviously the loans now in 2020 that are up for refinance. So we would expect to see quite a bit of activity on that. So we have to keep in mind, since historically 5 years ago we were at a peak and we had a lot of loan activity, and this has to go somewhere now.
Sure.
So, yeah, but coming to the retail story, there is it's hard to say. There is definitely no positive news, and I agree there has to be some, or there will be some repurposing, and there will be some new business plans that will sort of have a turnaround story for some centers. But it seems clear that we don't need all the retail space that there currently is, and some locations won't just work any longer. So what we see, I mean, there's a serious concern from the lender side, obviously, and they're working through those scenarios. I mean, in 2019, we didn't see many deals coming through on the market because there weren't any new valuations available. I think what we expect to see for 2020 is a lot more sales due to the fact that some of the retail funds have actually been under pressure.
Yes.
So we expect, or the lenders are also expecting, that some of these will be forced sellers, and that will lead to new valuations and a new level of pricing for these assets, which really was very vague in 2019. And that will then prompt some lenders to look into their strategies, I guess, whether they're going to go down the receiver route, whether they're going to go down the consensual workout route. It really depends. Receivership is very easy in the UK, and there have been quite some good success stories. So I do expect that, you know, we will see more appointments of receiverships over shopping centres, for example. Clearly it's a story that lenders will work with their borrowers together. We'll just see. So there will be some serious write-downs amongst those that have large exposures. And I believe, I mean, overall we can say, though, that it's a sector-specific story. It's not, we don't see a general structural problem with the whole of the industry. No. So it will stay sector-specific, and those who have exposures will have losses and write-downs to report.
Away from retail, looking at the market more broadly, what trends are we seeing in terms of pricing at the moment, John?
Pricing for assets or pricing in terms of...
Pricing debt? In terms of financing.
Financing. Yeah, I mean, it's remained fairly stable, I have to say, but there is still competition out there, so I think it still remains competitive. You know, interest rates have been fairly steady for some time, and I still think, as you look at banks now, the capital story is such an important one. So, you know, that cost of capital, understanding the cost of capital, starts to set, as I said, a fairly stable position in terms of where different banks are based within the market in terms of their pricing. And that risk-reward discussion, I think, is becoming a lot more disciplined and evolved in terms of where the market sits today. And I'm sure, you know, Nicole must see that in terms of the amount of real estate debt that's out there now. It's a lot more structured, thought through, in terms of the rush to the highest loan-to-value and the lowest price, which clearly was part of the pre-GFC issues.
Indeed. Does it feel that way to you, Nicole? We're seeing we have a more sensible outlook within the market today?
Yes, I would say. I mean, we're definitely not sort of over-levered in general terms in the sort of sectors like office, etc. I mean, lenders haven't gone overboard in sort of with leverage. Pricing, exactly, it's been fairly stable, but also competitive in the very prime segments. There are always, you know, an amount of lenders that will compete heavily in the London space. Mm. When you go out to the regions, obviously you have less lenders and they're more specialized and pricing is generally a little bit higher, but still already also competitive, right? I mean, what has repriced is obviously the retail segment. And I think where we will also see some repricing is the fact, and where there is leverage and a bit of concern, is those areas of retail where I think borrowers will have no other option but fill the equity gap that we'll see by asking for mezzanine loans. And that's already happening. And I think, again, those mezzanine lenders will ask for very high IRRs, obviously. And so that's, I think, where we will see some sort of over-leverage and, again, some people losing money.
Is that a warning sign for you then?
That is part of a little, as I say, it's not contagious to the rest of the market, but that part of the market, I mean, you mentioned the amber red signals, that for me is already red.
Okay. John, I wanted to stick with, we've touched there on sort of changing competition. As we see a more diverse lending market develop in the UK, I'm interested in where the opportunities open up for a lender such as Aldermore to take new market share, and maybe who that comes at the expense of as the makeup of this market shifts.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one area we're in is is development, which we've been doing for some time. We've been doing for 7 or 8 years now, actually, and doing it very safely. And that definitely is at the expense of, you just don't see many of those developments in competition from the likes of the clearing banks, who historically would have been there. And the majority of our competitors there tend to be specialist banks as well.
Okay.
So, but we've been very disciplined, and I use this line a lot, you know, we've stayed at a certain loan to GDV. We haven't changed. We'll be doing that for the next 7 years as well, because that's a safe place to be. We don't need to chase the market up. I think Nicole makes a good point about MES. MES is there. Generally, it works when the yields are higher. So hence why retail will be somewhere that, you know, yields have jumped fairly significantly in recent times. So MES may step in, only if they see a story, an asset management story, I think. And in terms of some of the other sectors, I think that they're, again, it's generally where we're playing, probably at the edges that the clearing banks are not playing at. And I think it's that personal touch. The relationship piece, that there is an individual to talk to, they are there, they respond quickly. A lot of the feedback we get, that's the real positive. That's where, don't feel that's really there in clearing banks.
That's interesting.
So much now, you know, that's and I don't think it's all clearing banks, and I think it'll be down to individuals in the bank in terms of how they act. But certainly I think the way that a lot of banks have organized themselves, they're not driven as well to that relationship model. And you know, real estate is such a long-term play. People just want to be able to pick up the phone. They don't want to explain the whole history of what they've done. They just want to pick up and say, yes, we've dealt with you before. We know what it is you look for. And it's that ease to deal with, I think, is the thing that drives and helps us. So, you know, is it at the expense of clearing banks? Probably a little bit of that. But, you know, there are a number of specialist banks in our area that do probably a fairly similar thing. So it's really down to the strength and the experience of the individuals they deal with.
Would you be able to point to particular clients and deals developments that you think exemplify that kind of relationship building that you focused on, that perhaps, as you say, the traditional clearing banks might have shifted away from simply because of the way they're structured?
Yeah, now. I mean, there's one that we've done a bit of marketing on, who were a contractor actually, and their aim was to become a developer. And their wording was great when we used it in a marketing space, because they said, we helped them become a developer probably 18 months before they thought they would get there because of we backed them. And I think that's a really good example of where, you know, you're listening, you're working with someone, you are backing them to move up the chain a little bit. And they wouldn't have got that. I mean, they said themselves, they just don't think they would have got that from anybody else. It was that real understanding. And you get that relationship building is a two-way thing. They trusted us, we worked with them, we trusted them, we saw what they did. So there's several examples like that I can see that we're starting to build out, and that's probably one of the best ones I can think of, mainly because they said it. We didn't even say, you have to say this. They actually said it and said, yeah, we've become a developer 18 months earlier than we thought we would do because of our backing.
What do you think the clearing banks might have missed on this front? Is there a natural consequence of sort of post GFC restructuring that has affected the way they work and communicate with clients? What do you see them missing?
Yeah, it's hard to say, given that I'm not in them anymore, and it's really hard to see someone. Maybe just because it is the size, I don't know, but you know, it's that fleet of foot for us. I can only talk about what we can do, and I think it is that quick reaction, fleet of foot. The feedback I get from clients when I speak to them is very much that you know we're there quickly, we make a decision quickly, what we say we're going to do, we do. That seems to be different from what,
yeah.
And I don't think that's for all. I think clearing banks would be very good for some borrowers, and it's probably starting to demark where there's some borrowers that I think would just be made for clearing banks and not for us, and there's others that are probably moving up the curve that maybe just clearing banks aren't an easy place to deal with unless you know somebody there.
Nicole, we touched on the flashing amber and red warning signals that you mentioned in the last issue of the report. What, maybe to delve back into that, what else might give you cause for concern when you look at the market at the moment? And we touched on the MES provision there, but is there anything else you see that would suggest to you there could be any troubles ahead that you would want to be aware of when you look at the market?
I mean, we've touched on the retail story, and that's the obvious one. But I think so far, logistics has obviously benefited from this whole problem and the whole shift the way people shop. So, although lenders currently feel it's overpriced, it could obviously become also problematic if you hold logistics in places where it's not really, where it becomes obsolete or you have competition. In the past, there have been these type of problems in that sector, but at the moment there seems to be still an undersupply. So I don't see any issues there. Again, also student accommodation, I think there is more operators now that realize that it costs them a lot more running these student accommodations, and they become obsolete. Like John also said, they realize now that students expect different types of things, or things get destroyed very quickly, and they have to the refurbishment costs are literally annually, they're very high. So there has been some pricing mistake, or maybe probably the rents have been sort of, the income was assumed to be higher than it is. But overall, I mean, from the lender side, yeah, leverage has been low. Yep. office sector is fine. Again, development lending, yes, you want to make sure. Developments is another area where quickly you could lose money. But it will be individual stories.
John, anything that you're keeping your eye on that has the possibility to keep you awake at night, as it were?
At the moment, I'm really very comfortable where we are. As I said, I think, you know, we're building out our offering. So, you know, we don't have a huge exposure to certain sectors, and we don't have a huge exposure to retail. So, which is why I can understand that concern. But that really is because you've got a huge paradigm shift in terms of rental tone and yields. So that double whammy really does affect where you might have been valued a year ago or 2 years ago. I mean, the development thing, as I said, is something that inherently has some risks. So you just have to be really careful what you do, and that is generally about who do you get involved with, who are you backing. And every time you come into this, it is definitely about the borrowers and who you're backing. Their strategy, is it sensible? Because ultimately, if you're getting into a long-term partnership with someone, you're backing their strategy. So that's something we do a lot of homework on.
Sure.
And I suppose that's why we feel fairly comfortable where we are, because you know, every one of the deals we do, there's that interaction at a personal level through people on the team, and it's something that we can kind of carry on doing, I suppose, in terms of where we're trying to grow the business.
And we started this conversation with the Boris bounce. Interested to know whether there are policies or initiatives coming from this new government that excite you or perhaps worry you when you look at the real estate markets?
Certainly in housing, and you know, as a major player in terms of providing residential mortgages as well as property development, that's really important to us. So that does excite us. And also, the you know, we have to think forward and think to the future. So looking at things like the green agenda, I think it's quite important and something that we really want to focus on in terms of what we're doing and how we impact on the environment in terms of developments that we're looking to do. Something that we have at high importance and looking to try and partner in terms of that as well. So that does give me some confidence going forward. I think, you know, we do need to have, is thinking about the future. What does that look like? How can we be part of that? How can we assist in that?
Absolutely. All important. Well, John, Nicole, thank you both very much for making time to be here with EG today. And thank you for listening.